Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Michael Roth, who has served as the 16th president of Wesleyan University since 2007. Dr. Roth previously served as president of California College of the Arts. He graduated from Wesleyan in 1978, earned a master's and doctorate in history from Princeton, and is a respected historian, author, and curator. President Michael Roth, we are so proud to have you here with us, and you run a wonderful institution, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start out with a little biography. People like to know who we're talking to. Tell us a little about yourself.
Well, I, as you mentioned, I'm a Wesleyan grad, and I got to Middletown, Connecticut in the mid-70s from a big public high school in Long Island. My parents, as we would say, didn't know from college.
Is that true?
That's right. My father was a furrier, and his father was a furrier. And the only thing we knew for sure, we agreed on, was that I should not become a furrier. And so I was visiting colleges. I was a bookish kid. I wanted to be an athlete and hurt my knee as many times as you could hurt a knee, not doing anything particularly well, but and became a reader as a result of my athletic inabilities.
But you're thin and you have the look of a runner, are
good.
You?
I am not, but I'm glad. It's all an illusion, but I do get on machines that make me sweat, and I do still enjoy playing some sports, but I turned to books as a kid and wound up at Wesleyan visiting with some friends and fell in love with the place immediately. I met a group of wild and crazy and creative students when I was visiting. I had never met people like that. They sent me to a co-ed fraternity, as they said, because I wanted to become a writer. And I was so intrigued and even befuddled by the notion that you could have a co-ed fraternity, met a bunch of incredible people who I'm still in touch with, poets and musicians and political activists. And I felt like this was the place for me. And so I came to Wesleyan and discovered what I love to do and involve lots of hard work, but always lots of fun.
Some people think that Wesleyan is the best college in America. Is it?
I think it is. It's not the best college for everybody. We don't want to be the best college for everybody. But if for students who are searching for the kind of work that will provide them with fulfillment, where they can make a contribution to society and also engage their deepest interests, it is among the best colleges in America.
Somebody once said to me that kids who go to Harvard should go to Antioch, and that the people who go to Antioch should go to Harvard, because some people who want that space aren't really disciplined enough to use it.
Well, at Wesleyan, we have a rigorous selection process, and
you know,
fewer than 20% of the students who apply get in, although many of them are really qualified. We certainly don't want all the students who wind up going to Harvard. People often go to Harvard for exactly what they're going to get, which is the networking opportunity of meeting other people who want to go to Harvard. People come to Wesleyan because they want to find a student culture that's vibrant and alive, that will expand their musical and political and literary horizons. They'll find a faculty who are devoted teachers as well as scholars. And a community, they'll be incredibly supportive.
I had a friend from Bennington, and she dropped out in the last year. And I said to her, "Why'd you drop out?" And she said, "If you've graduated from Bennington, you've missed the point of the education." So I've often wondered about that. You got a reaction?
Yeah. At Wesleyan, I think the we have a different issue, I think, that most of the students in their senior year, or at least I should say many of the students in their senior year, don't want to finish because they realize there's no sense in which you're finishing your education. That is, you're being launched into a lifetime where you'll continue to learn. There are people like myself who finish early. I spent only 3 years at Wesleyan.
Really?
Because I thought, try to save my parents some money, and I knew I was going to do some more schooling at some point. What I got from Wesleyan, and I think students still get today, is the sense that learning is a lifelong project, and college is not just a happy vacation, but it's an opportunity to find out what you love to do and then get better at it.
You, like my daughter, did a doctorate at Princeton. as they say in the Blue Books, compare and contrast Wesleyan with Princeton.
Well, for me, Princeton was not a very exciting place after Wesleyan. I went there to do history, which it was certainly the best European history program in the country at the time. There were some wonderful people. I didn't major in history at Wesleyan. I made up my own major. Mm. I tell my students I majored in procrastination at Wesleyan because I couldn't make up my mind. I knew I was pretty good at history, conventional discipline, was interested in psychopathology, so I was doing a lot on Freud, and I worked in a mental hospital, and then I discovered philosophy. So at Wesleyan, they said to me, listen, you don't have to choose. You can actually combine these things. And so my official major was the history of psychological theory.
Whoa.
And which is a long way of saying I was interested in how people make sense of the past. And I was accepted at Princeton, and I was lucky enough to get a fellowship, so I decided I better take it. My parents were very happy. And I was very fortunate. I had wonderful teachers at Wesleyan and at Princeton. Carl Schursky, who I met as a freshman at Wesleyan and had taught there in the past, was my Dr. Vater at Princeton and a wonderful man, a great friend. But I also got to work with Richard Rorty in philosophy and Sheldon Wolin in political theory.
Wow.
And it was just a great group of people. But I lived in New York. I took the train to Princeton. I wasn't part of that community. For me, it was a place to work with teachers. My wife today is a graduate of Princeton from the same period. She was a graduate student. She actually enjoyed Princeton. She worked in a bakery. She had a life there. I was a New Yorker who took the train, did my work, and came home.
I can understand that very well. I mean, I worked at New Paltz for over 40 years, and I got to tell you, what kept me out of faculty wars was the fact that I commuted from Great Barrington.
Yes, yes.
It was good. You know, it just kept me out of all of that academic terrible stuff. I am so proud to have you here because your interests and mine are absolutely on the same level. I studied Freud in graduate school. I was an NIMH fellow. They were training a cadre of political scientists who would understand mental health issues. Tell us a little bit about the past and Freud.
Well, I was introduced to Freud probably at a too young an age. I had an uncle who became an ex-football player and then a psychoanalyst. And he took me for my bar mitzvah, I think it was, to the 8th Street Bookshop in New York, which was a great bookstore in the village. And we walked around and he picked stuff off the shelves for me and said, you should read this, you should read that. So I wound up taking a book of Freud's, actually a rather long book.
Do you remember the name?
Oh, yes. Introduction to Psychoanalysis, which are the Vienna lectures from 1916, 1917. Not a good place to start. Much too long, much too complicated for a high school student. I took it to summer camp, Alan, and I had it
and
at
where
the pool.
Was that?
In the Poconos in Honesdale, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Camp Cayuga. And so I knew when I got to college, I knew a lot more about Freud than people in psychology because they didn't care about Freud anymore.
And they were dealing with rats.
They were dealing with rats and numbers, and I was very interested in the stories. Interested in the stories. How do you make sense of your past when you have a crazy mother? This resonated with me. How do you make sense of the past when you have a tragedy in the background? And these are the questions that I found so interesting. Not because I thought
tragedy
Freud
in the background being the Holocaust.
Well, it could be a people's tragedy like the Shoah, or it could be a personal tragedy. It could be, you know, everyone has a complicated past, and what interested me was how people learn to deal with that past, either historically at the group level, personally at the psychological level, and then philosophy helped me think about it and perhaps kept me from making too many mistakes about mixing apples and oranges.
So what do we take away from Freud in terms of historical perspective?
Well, Freud helps us understand why integrating a sense of history is important to living a life of relative freedom, by which I mean Freud insisted that in order to love and work in a culture without too much pain, you had to find a way of dealing with your past, of making your own sense of the past, your own history, part of your present. Otherwise, you're either a robot or you're going to be controlled by someone else, or you're going to be merely reactive to your immediate surroundings. Freud insisted that a life of reflection that included a sense of the past was vital to being a human. And he may have been wrong about what parts of the past were so important, and which, you know, what happens before 4 years old is more important than what happens after 8 years old. These are empirical questions, and I'm sure Freud couldn't be right about most of them.
Well, was he right about 4 years old and your character is set forever?
Well, I don't think he ever really said that. He did say that decisive things happen in periods of our lives that we don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very intriguing hypothesis. That
are you who you were when you were four?
I am. Mm-hmm. I'm not the same person, but I am.
Basic character? Yeah.
Well, I don't think that... I think that a framework for character is set pretty early, and that at the same time, we are not prisoners of the of that framework forever, and that there is a way in which you coming to understand your that the framework that you've been given can actually liberate you from that framework.
Hence psychoanalysis.
Hence love. I mean, in other words,
Eros and Thanatos.
Yes, and people's lives change dramatically because not just because of what happens, obviously psychologically, but what happens to them in politics, what happens to them in society.
We are having a wonderful conversation, which I couldn't be happier about, with Dr. Michael Roth, who is the 16th president of Wesleyan University, if not the best, one of the best in the country and the world. Michael, if I may call you that.
Of course.
So Freud wrote a book called Civilization and Its Discontents. What do we take away from that?
Well, I think two things. One is that aggression is here to stay. That is, you can't wish away parts of human beings that are unpleasant. And Freud, throughout Civilization and Discontents, criticizes the turn to religion as a turn away from the reality of aggression and sexuality. And in Civilization and Discontents, which really is written in the shadow of World War One, he emphasizes how the effort to deny that we are aggressive and violent creatures usually means that we're going to come out with more aggression and violence. If you bottle it up, it will explode. I mean, that's in a word, right? That's the Freudian mantra. If you bottle it up, it will explode, whether it's sex or aggression. And in Civilization and Discontents, he's telling us that we punish ourselves because we can't let out our aggression. And so guilt, which is probably as familiar to you as it is to me.
Very much.
guilt is a manifestation of our aggressive side that we turn against ourselves because we don't live up to some ideal. And so in a nutshell, Civilization and Discontents say, don't kill yourself because you're not living up to your ideals. Remember that there is pleasure in the world and that there is pain, but to deny yourself the opportunity for love and for work is going to bottle things up in such a way that they will explode, either in your personal life or on the street sometime.
Did you see the recent film which portrayed the relationship between Freud and Jung?
No, A Dangerous Method. I haven't seen it yet. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I know the book and some of the background.
It's interesting stuff. Freud was portrayed in that film as being a stand-up guy and a guy who really had a sense of values. And if somebody else crossed the line, he didn't like it. And yet, you know, what you've been telling us is that he also said, you know, you can be somewhat forgiving to yourself. But I didn't get the feeling he was forgiving towards Jung.
No, well, he, of course, had a very intense relationship with Jung, who for him represented the opportunity to make psychoanalysis less associated with Jews and more associated with kind of what he imagined would be mainstream science. He was completely wrong, of course, on both counts, since Jung was no friend of the Jews and was as far away from mainstream science as you can get. But Freud did put a lot of hope in Jung, and Jung's relationship to Freud by at the same time was deeply ambivalent, wanting to get out of Freud's shadow and also wanting to get away from this notion that sexuality plays such an important role in human character. But that relationship with Jung prompted Freud to rethink his own theories in a very dramatic way. And I think that was, in the history of psychoanalysis, that's very interesting.
How?
Well, he emphasized aggression after the break with Jung is 1913, and Freud is accused by Jung of being only interested in sexuality. As we know, Jung was exploring sexuality in the flesh, so to speak.
And Freud wasn't happy about it.
No, and Freud wasn't happy about it. But Jung wasn't happy that Freud was so interested in sexuality, theoretically speaking. And so Freud is a thinker who was animated by conflict. He needed conflict at the center of his ideas. And so he realized that you have to have something fighting against sexuality and for his theory to work. And that was aggression, or as you said before, thanatos, I mean, the death instinct. And with World War I looming, a focus on aggression was, I think, unavoidable for Freud. And so he saw this war between we have in ourselves, between the side of ourselves that is wanting to combine with other people, wanting to be with other people, the erotic side, and the side that really wants to eliminate all connection, the aggressive side.
So, Michael Roth, do you like Freud after having been so intimate with him all of your life?
Oh, I don't always like Freud, and because as you study someone, there are lots, warts and all, there are lots of things that don't make a lot of sense. I find Freud's anti-moralism incredibly appealing. That his insistence
I'm sorry. What do you mean by anti-moralism?
That is that moral conventions he thought were overrated as regulations on our erotic and aggressive life.
He didn't forgive Jung for his misbehavior.
Right, but because it had consequences that Jung was not willing to accept.
Uh-huh.
Not because it was a violation of an ethical sanction that proposed by society, but because there is accountability. Accountability is different from moralism. Moralism, as we hear on the campaign trail all the time, is just pontificating about values which you can't live up to. Freud thought that was disingenuous or hypocritical, and it was also very unhealthy. But accountability for your action is another matter. And you know, Freud, of course, we know from the biographers that he made lots of mistakes and did things that are unaccountable, you know, that he violated his own theories. I'm not a biographer. I'm interested in how people make sense of trauma over time. My last collection of essays is called Memory, Trauma, and History. And it really has to do with how doctors recognize people who were plagued by the past, especially doctors 100, 200 years ago. I'm interested in how photographers seize on the past in their work, how photography changes our relationship to the past. I'm interested in how educators bring a sense of history to their students, how a university is a custodian of the past and not just an enterprise that is supposed to make progress for the future. I think all of these interests for me came through Freud in some way, although I don't see that my work in all of those areas is Freudian in any way.
I don't know where to go next. You put so many ideas out there, Michael Roth, that they're just fascinating. My style of interviewing is somebody throws something down and, you know, you sort of follow the thought. But in the beginning, we talked a little bit about how by the time you came along, the psychologists were thinking more about rats and, you know, various formidable equations than they were about what we, many of us now think of as the real stuff. So, and then you go and you say, well, but academic institutions are the place where these treasures are kept. And yet, and you're a historian, the history of thought is obviously influenced by who you give tenure to at a university, who becomes, you know, the keeper of that thought and who poo-poos Freudians.
Yes. Well, I do think that there are ways of thinking that come in and out of fashion, and that's a natural course of cultural development. And you know, any psychologist writing in the beginning of the 20th century is not going to be followed at the beginning of the 21st. I think that's nothing to feel too bad about. I think the role of university in preserving the opportunity to study great works of literature and social theory and the like is absolutely crucial, and especially in America, where we have a tendency to race ahead to the next big thing, to try to get on board with the latest fad. Our university has the obligation, I think, to remind students of the past, even though as it prepares them for the future.
The book is Memory, Trauma, and History, Essays on Living with the Past. The author is Michael S. Roth, and he is not only the president of Wesleyan, but a very thoughtful man about our history and how we look at it. Of course, Michael, if you know, the analogy is that there's a pool of water and the pebble drops in the water and you have concentric circles coming out. I just don't want to beat the horse about universities. But obviously, if a university is well known for a particular kind of thinking, it takes a long time before that onus goes away.
Yes, it's very interesting. Wesleyan, for example, has been well known since the late 1960s as a very progressive institution.
Indeed.
And I'm very proud of that. And I'm sure one of the attractions for me when I came in the mid-70s was that side of the place. In fact, I used to joke that Wesleyan entered the 60s in about 1955 when Norman O'Brown published Life Against Death and Marcuse was on campus and Bucky Fuller was on campus and Herbert Marcuse was on campus and all these wonderfully interesting and exciting people in the 50s who were teaching our students. And up until the 80s, this reputation lingered. I do think that it's very important for our students at Wesleyan today to realize they're at an institution that wants to make a difference in the public sphere, that our students often go off and found great profitable companies like Southwest Airlines, or they go off to become football coaches like Bill Belichick. I mean, they do all kinds of interesting things outside of the activism. But there is an ethos of contributing to the world and having a positive impact on the public sphere that's very important for Wesleyan students. And so in the last 5 years, we've really emphasized once again that Wesleyan is a place not just for protest, but Wesleyan is a place for civic engagement, where our students, and hundreds of them do this, work in the community, work in schools, they work in government. They are actively preparing themselves to be more thoughtful and effective citizens. And Wesleyan is a place for artists. It's been a long time tradition that avant-garde people find Wesleyan not just a haven, but an inspiration. But we see that civic engagement and creativity is not just confined to the arts and to the activists, that our science programs are places where there's path-breaking research being done in stem cell fields, for example, that innovation in chemistry and physics at Wesleyan is really important because we have very small graduate programs, which allows us to our undergraduates to work on cutting-edge research funded by the national foundations or by the government. And so the ethos of activism and creativity isn't just about painters, musicians, and protesters. It's about innovation across the curriculum. It's about civic engagement all over the university. And it's about creativity wherever we can nurture it.
Of course, if you're listening to this right now, you want to know, if you've just turned the radio on, who you're listening to. And it's Michael S. Roth. The book that he's just come out with is Memory, Trauma, and History, Essays on Living with the Past. And he is the president of Wesleyan. So you just told us about Wesleyan, and you're the keeper of the flame in many ways. You want to keep this thing going as the president. How do you do that with faculty? I mean, you give them the head and just say anybody can do anything they want, or somebody does something that you find philosophically objectionable. What do you do?
That's a great question. Well, I am the keeper of the flame, as you say, and the president. I'm also on the faculty. I teach every semester, and it's very important for me. And when I was hired, I remember somebody on the board of trustees said, "Well, you really want to teach? I mean, why would you? You're going to be very busy." And I thought I didn't get into this racket because I wanted to be an administrator. I stayed around universities because I love students, and I love to teach, and I love to read and write and think with my colleagues. And so when something happens on the faculty, I react as a faculty member most of the time. I mean, there are some, you know, exceptions. And when we
join sides? I mean, do you take sides?
I try to weigh in judiciously because I am, although I think of myself as a faculty member, some of my colleagues think of me as the president. And and I have to be careful not to overlook the symbolic dimension of the job. But when we talk about curricular development and we talk about the development of new fields of learning at Wesleyan, and we have several new programs that have been spawned over the last few years, I try to help that process along as a colleague, as a faculty member, but I also can bring resources to bear because I am the president and I'm actively involved in fundraising. So I'll give you an example because it sounds so general that when I started 5 years ago, I asked the faculty for the best ideas they have for creating new programs. And I received 50-some-odd proposals, and we put them through a process. And in the end, the proposal that really rose to the top in most areas was the College of the Environment. a new interdisciplinary environmental studies program, in which all the students would have double majors, so they would be doing environmental science and public policy through political science or economics, or environmental science and the arts, or some combination of enterprises that would allow them to bring to bear on the most important environmental issues that face us, a wealth of techniques and disciplines. Well, this was something we were able to get started. We have a think tank that's attached to it where research gets done with faculty and undergraduates and an outside expert. It's led by a biologist named Barry Chernoff, who's just an extraordinary guy, a wonderful scientist. He's also a pretty good guitar player in our local rock band. And the students—
Are you in the band also?
I sit in and play some keyboards, but— But they let me come in only for a few songs. But in any case, that's an example where, as a colleague and as a president, we can help nurture a program like the College of the Environment. We've added a lot of resources to our creative writing program. Recently, we brought the writer Amy Bloom, who's actually an alumna, back to campus to help us to lead these efforts in adding more creative writing courses to the curriculum. So there are places where I think my closeness to the faculty and students helps me be a better president.
How important is it, Michael Roth, to have a PhD?
How important is it for
a faculty member to have a PhD?
Oh, it's really an interesting question. In most fields, it's very important because it shows that you have mastered the material and that you are productively engaged in research in that field. But in some fields, it matters not at all. So, for example, do I care if Amy Bloom has a PhD? I do not care. What I care about is she a great writer? Does she write really well? Is she publishing books that other people think are wonderful? Can she teach very effectively? We're hiring now someone for an endowed chair in civic engagement. And some of my faculty colleagues asked me just this question. Well, it's an endowed chair. It's very important. Doesn't this person have to have a PhD? I said, I don't care.
It's a union card, of course, to a lot of faculty members.
But I have no interest at all in that. I'm interested in what have they done and what can they do? In some fields, let's say like biophysics, having a PhD is a good sign that they're prepared. But in civic engagement, no thank you. In journalism, no thank you. In creative writing, no thank you. I mean, I'm not disqualifying people who have a PhD. Sure. But my last presidency was at an art school. And I'll tell you, at an art school, most of my art colleagues thought it did disqualify you. Because if you were an artist or if you were a designer or an architect, you didn't have a PhD. You were out there in this working. You were out there doing the job. And I think in some fields, that is a better sign of potential than where you went to school or what degree you have.
You come to this the first person in your family to have gone to college.
Well, my brother did as well, but my parents didn't. Yeah.
Your parents didn't, and therefore, how does that color your perspective about academics?
Well, I think that I bring to this a sense of humor about the foibles of academia that I got from certainly from my parents and from my brother. Who is in the business world, and you know, I think we have to be able to laugh at ourselves sometimes. We professors, and I, you know, count myself in this group, at some of the arcane things we do, and you know, some of the things I've written are for very small audiences, because they have to deal with Hegel or some small point in Freud. And then other things I do are really for larger audiences. I just heard this talk recently from my teacher, Henry Abeloff at Wesleyan, who said, and I think it's exactly right, when you're teaching, you have to always pay attention to whom your message is addressed. Just like when you're talking to your friend, you don't talk the same way to all your friends. You talk differently to your different friends. And we in academia, I think most of the time realize this, I hope so, that as teachers and as intellectuals and as citizens, we have to pay attention to the people we're speaking with and know what they need when they need it. If you're a good teacher, you know who your audience is and you try to respect them and also lead them to a place where from which they can benefit.
We are talking to Michael S. Roth. The book is Memory, Trauma, and History, Essays on Living with the Past. So how do you marry, Michael, the arts and Freud?
Well, I haven't really tried to marry them so much, I suppose. But in the in this new book, there is some essays on photography, for example, and which I became interested in photography as a historian of the 19th century to see how photography changes the way we relate to the past. And as a technology of representing the past, does it seems like an aid to memory and for many people. But it also, of course, replaces your memory. And so, just like if you don't have a great sense of direction, I'll put myself in that camp. If you get a GPS, your sense of direction is going to get a lot worse because you never use it. Just like your handwriting gets a lot worse when you don't use your computer. I think our memories don't improve through the use of photography. I was at my brother's for Seder, before we even went to sleep after the Seder, he was showing everyone the pictures he had taken during the Seder, and the pictures replaced the experience. This interests me a great deal. And it's the same kind of interest, I think, that brought me to Freud. So I have an essay in the book about a wonderful photographer named David Maisel, who's based in San Francisco, who did a project on photographs of urns that have the cremated remains of patients in the state mental hospital in Salem, Oregon. And they're beautiful pictures. They're haunting. They're difficult. And at the same time, there's a great backstory to them because of the efforts of family members to track down their ancestors who were at this hospital. And David went and did this project. He asked me to write about mental health, mental hospitals, remains, and photography, probably because of these interests that we have in common. And for me, it was a privilege to write about his work in relation to the history of psychology and to our relationship to the past. And as a result, we in our house in Monterey, we have a lovely David Maisel picture as a reward for writing about it.
Just bring us a little further, if you would, Michael, in terms of what we learn from photography of urns with dead people inside of them.
What we learn from them is that the effort to get rid of the traces of people who were residents of this hospital in Oregon are efforts that fail because, just like Freud said, when you bottle something up and you pay no attention to it, it explodes. Here they tried for generations to deny that these people had lived there. They were there for who knows what reason. Some of them were their wives committed by their husbands because they were tired of these women. Other people who had very significant illnesses. Other people who just were homeless. They lived there. They worked in the laundry. They farmed the farm. It was a whole community. And then what do you do with these people when they die? There's no more room in the cemetery, but they're not the administrators are not total beasts, although this was where they filmed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They're not beasts. They actually try to do something with these remains, but they don't know what to do with them. And so they put them in these urns and they try to hide them somewhere. And over time, things happen to these objects that make them even more interesting as objects, but they don't go away. The past does not go away. And David Maisel's photographs remind us of this important thing, that you by denying the past, actually, you do yourself a disservice and you forget this important lesson that by forgetting or denying the past, you corrupt the present.
We're talking to Michael Roth. He's the president of Wesleyan University. The book is Memory, Trauma, and History. Michael, let me ask you this. In our house, the Shartok House in Great Barrington,
mm-hmm.
The house is filled with wonderful pictures of our children and us having a great time.
Yes.
Now, I love my children, and I think they've done extraordinarily well in life and all the rest of it.
But
I think they'd be a little bit rougher on me than the pictures suggest in terms of my ability to go out there at Little League games,
yes.
and be present during all of this stuff. Now adults. So the pictures by themselves can sometimes lie and present a false consciousness, a false history.
Absolutely. And that's one of the points about photography that I discuss in this book in an essay called Photographic Ambivalence, is that photographs necessarily distort the past, as our memories do, because we're always reshaping the past every time we remember. And this is not a call for us to abandon photography, but it is a reminder that we shouldn't let photography replace experience. I remember when my daughter, who's now a freshman in high school, was just being born. At some moment, the obstetrician turned to me and said, "Where's your camera?" And I didn't have a camera. I said, I don't have a camera. He said, where's your camera? And everyone in the room, they stopped their administrations and turned, you don't have a camera? Don't you care about this event? I said, yes, I do. Actually, please pay attention to my wife. She's in great pain. We're having a baby here. And they were, for them, not having a camera was a sign of a lack of care, which I think is really kind of crazy. And I actually was trying to be there and not be a photographer of the event, but actually be there and have this experience with my wife and our little Sophie. But there are times when my little Sophie now turns to me and says, Daddy, don't you care? Don't you care about me? Don't you want to take a picture?
Where were you when I was coming out?
So I think that photography plays this really interesting role. As
absolutely.
Both reminder and distorter.
It can be a distorter. I mean, I know dysfunctional families, and I've seen them, in which the photograph replaces all of the anxiety of family, in which, you know, the photograph becomes the issue.
Yes, absolutely. I teach a course at Wesleyan called Photography and Representation, in which we get to look at these issues, both in dramatic historical events that are subject to photography, and then on these personal levels. And I always ask the students to bring in photographs that matter to them and to talk to the class about why a particular photograph is hanging on their desk or sitting next to their bed, and what does it mean to them? And I must say, I hear these wonderful stories, sometimes quite sad stories, from students about their emotional investment in particular photographic images, which I think is quite different from their investment in paintings or in other artworks.
So, for example, give us one story from one student.
Sure. It's in the book, actually, in an essay about teaching. We were working with this writer, Roland Barthes, who says that all photographs have this what he calls a punctum, this element that wounds you, that is not always explicit. And I asked the students to bring in pictures, and this one student, she actually paused and she said, "Well, I couldn't bring in this picture. I just couldn't do it." And she said, "Because it's a picture of my family in the backyard of our house." This is in California. And it's my sister and I and my mom, and you can see, she says, I can see where my father isn't. Because the year before we had this picture, and my father was in it, but this picture that I have now is after my parents were divorced, and she gets all choked up, and the whole class is choked up. We don't know what to do with this. It kind of, not just confession, but her trust in us as a class, that she could tell us this story. I think her friends in the class had no idea this was going on in this young woman's life. And she said, this picture is about, for me, about who's not in it. This picture is about my father, who I don't see anymore. And so here we had this extraordinary moment in the class where we could think about what we choose to remember, what we choose to erase, and how we carry the emotional scars of that process.
Well, in case anybody doesn't know out there, I'm loving this interview with Michael S. Roth, who is the president of one of our great universities, if not the greatest, Wesleyan. Michael, tell us about Freud in the arts.
Well, Freud, of course, had strong interests in antiquities, and he was...
So if you go into some psychologist's office, you'll always see some African antiquity of some kind sitting up there on the mantelpiece.
Yes, that's right. And for Freud, it was part of his deep investment in the archaic. You know, he was interested in things that, again, that past that persists but may not be easily called to mind. A lot of psychoanalysts over the years have, I think, done a disservice to this thinking by crudely applying psychoanalysis to artists and saying, well, this Picasso represents some Oedipal conflict, and this other sculpture, Louise Bourgeois, obviously represents a traumatic experience that is being overcome, blah, blah, blah. And that I think, is kind of, it's unfortunate. I think what is interesting for me in psychoanalytic approaches to the arts are the ways that we can pay attention to how certain artworks are traces of the past and give us the ability to think coherently about how the art process allows artists to work through issues that they have in their personal lives, and how certain artworks become objects of our own emotional and psychological investment. Give you an example.
Sure.
The Vietnam Memorial, Meyer Lind's Vietnam Memorial, sure, in Washington, D.C., when it was first proposed and first built, of course, it was this enormous scandal. Everybody thought, this is awful. It's a disservice. It's not glorious enough for our soldiers who suffered so. And then over the years, of course, it's become this wonderful place of refuge, of emotional investment, where people can bring their past to the monument and find some comfort and solace in their interaction with it. Well, that description I just gave you is not just Freudian, but certainly that the Freudian framework allows us to understand the way the object functions as both a representative of the past and a screen on which we can project our own relationship to the past.
I'm about to ask you a question which probably has no relevance whatsoever, but I'll try it anyway.
Okay, here we go.
We once had a psychologist in our living room who was at one of the better-known psychoanalytic institutes in our area.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this guy took great offense when we moved over to a different side of the room when we were living in Alford and saw that I had put my mother's Rorschach tests up on the wall.
Uh-huh.
And he yelled at me. He said, "This is the most unprofessional thing I have ever seen." I always thought, you know, anything could be art, and this was,
yes,
this was great art. So I wonder about your sense of what's professional in life and what's not. I scream back at the guy. I'm not a psychologist.
What, well, I think you should take it as a compliment, right? I mean, when people say something is not professional, they usually are saying, "I don't understand how to react to this." I mean, that's usually what it means. And I think that professional decorum is vastly overrated. I mean, sometimes it keeps people from hitting each other, but usually when they don't hit each other, they do something even worse later on. So I think that the...
I want to pursue that a minute.
Yes.
What do you mean it keeps people from hitting each other?
Well, I mean, some kinds of professional decorum, instead, when people are really angry at each other, they have to actually use their words, as we tell our children, right? You have to use their words. That's a kind of decorum that professions foster. Okay. But they also can foster deflections of aggression into other media that are just really awful. But I do think that universities have become over-professionalized. They become over-specialized, or too much administration,
too
much bureaucracy,
yep,
and that the great antidote to professionalization are students. Students today who are free, who are eager to learn, who are not bound by disciplines, they remind us that the world doesn't come packaged in disciplines and in bureaucratic units or in professions. They remind us that the world is to be remade by energies of young and old people.
But what happens when one of your faculty members looks at one of those students who says, "Don't give me this crap," says the student to the professor. The professor looks back and says, "When you understand what this discipline is all about and discipline is about, where do you come down on something like that?" Certainly some of those students are going to arrive in your office at some point.
Yes. Well, I think that there are students who feel, as they sit in the classroom, that this stuff is nonsense, or this Roth theory is full of crap. Listen to him. I would prefer they say it to me, frankly.
Sure.
Because if they're thinking it, if they bottle it up, they're going to not learn. If they tell me, "Roth, I think what you just said about Freud is nonsense. It doesn't make, I don't get, it's crazy." I teach a course now on movies and philosophy. So we just watched Random Harvest, a wonderful melodrama with Ronald Coleman and Greer Garson. I know some of the students think Roth is nuts to show us this film that seems so schmaltzy, so cheesy, and he's going to have us read philosophy with this. Now, if they don't bring that to class and talk about it, I can't teach them. If they just hold it out and hold their hand out as a stop, like with a stop motion, they're never going to learn. I need them to break through that decorum to be able to be honest with me, not to be the throw of an object at me, but to be honest with me so that I can try to be their teacher.
The difference? I'm sorry, Michael.
Yes.
Is that the difference between a Wesleyan student and maybe a State University student who I've taught over the years, and I couldn't agree more with what you've just said, but who is basically saying, you know, give me the stuff, I'll vomit it back, I'll hold it, rather than fight with you.
Well, I don't know how that goes at other places, but I can tell you that the Wesleyan students, they do fight with us. And all of them?
Or no, are some of them smart enough to sit there and say, I'll just eat this?
No, well, if they have that attitude, they shouldn't be there. And I am very direct in saying that to them. I mean, I think this is an opportunity. Being at a place like Wesleyan is an opportunity to learn. And if you waste that opportunity, it's not going to come back to you most likely later on in life. And so finding the place to challenge your professor or to ask the question because you don't understand the material, not because you want to get a better grade, because the grades are meaningless. What matters is that you have a chance to expand your horizons, to go places you thought you could never go.
Is there a line? I mean, in other words, I remember a guy who ran a mental hospital in the Bronx I knew quite well. He's a famous psychiatrist. And he was sort of a guy who embraced Franz Fanon and all the rest, and he would tell his staff, the day that you carry me out of here and throw me out in the street, I will know you have succeeded. I will have succeeded. Of course, the day that they did carry him come out, he said, not yet.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm sort of wondering if, even though, you know, you make a very articulate presentation, and one which I so totally subscribe to, that you really want this, is there a point where it gets to be dangerous?
Of course. That there are boundaries that enable this kind of work to take place. So, as I said, if somebody throws something at me, I'm actually not going to have a discussion with them. I'm going to have them removed from the class and removed from the university. Because once violence enters the picture, you can't have the conversation.
But there's still, for the sake of argument, a professor that has been at Wesleyan for, you know, 30 years, something like that, who is just offended by somebody who gets up and makes a loud noise and says, this is disrespectful, you can't learn if you're just going to make noise for the sake of making noise. I've had students like that. Then somebody has got to have some rules.
Sure, there are rules, and most of the rules are actually enforced by the students themselves, because the students are there. When someone stands up in that way and keeps everybody else from learning, everyone knows that this is not about an argument over an issue. This is about a student acting out, just as a professor did it, everyone would know. And the students have a great capacity at a place like Wesleyan to ensure that the learning environment is successful. At this talk of Abelhoff's the other day, his whole freshman seminar from 3 years ago came as a group to the class, to this lecture he gave. And they were used to, whenever there was a question like that where you'd say, well, Roth, you're full of crap. This is not the right way to go about it. Mm-hmm. You'd say, let's look at the text again. Let's go back, in this case, to Thoreau. And the students said, yes, let's go back to Thoreau and let's look at it together. And there was this kind of communal commitment to learning that from which everybody benefited, including the professor. I mean, we learn, as you know, I mean, we learn from our students all the time.
What is it about history that is so dangerous?
Well, two things come to mind immediately. The first is that in history we find out about things we've done wrong that we have not been held accountable for.
For example,
we find out that we have betrayed the Constitution by locking up people who without cause. And we find out that we have been oppressing a group of people in ways that violate not only our conscience but our laws, and that these people, and that there's some accountability at stake, that there are people who should be brought to justice. And so for the for people who have benefited from injustice, and in the United States there are many, history is threatening because it shows that their wealth or privilege or power is built on the violation of rules that they had seemed to have been committed to. In the recent financial meltdown, there are lots of examples of this, of people whose wealth has been saved despite their own violations of the law.
Had no accountability.
No accountability. And the other thing that history is dangerous for is that history also shows us possibilities that we didn't take, that we don't have to be satisfied with the status quo. And maybe that's the most general answer I can give you. History shows us that we don't have to be satisfied with the status quo. Because people, part of what growing up is said to be is, you give up your ideals, you give up your dreams. But history shows you that these dreams actually have a vitality and have power, and that you don't have to be complacent. You don't have to be satisfied with the way things are. And that history then can energize you to help change the world.
What do you think Freud made of Hitler?
Oh, well, you know, Freud saw the eruption of Nazism and of Hitler in particular as his worst nightmare fulfilled. That is, that here was a society dedicated to order and the bottling up of impulse exploding in the most violent paroxysm of aggression, and led by someone who claimed extraordinarily tight allegiance and then let out the energy by finding a scapegoat against whom he could direct that aggression, namely the Jews. And so for Freud, this was a horrible example of a tendency that was deep in Western history, which is to control, 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 and then when that something has to explode, and then it explodes against a vulnerable group, in this case, the Jews.
Hmm. When you have to ask people for money for...
Well, that was a switch.
Well, I've got a couple of seconds. I'm always fascinated by how this works.
Yeah.
You have a philosophy. It is a beautiful philosophy. I mean, you know, I really admire you and the work you're doing. And yet, there's going to come a point at which you're sitting across a table from some guy.
Probably right after I leave this office
who's got a lot of money.
Yep.
Who might ask you to do something you don't want to do?
Well, I haven't had that problem. I mean, I have the alumni I work with and the parents I work with at Wesleyan. They know what we want to do with the university. And when I ask them for support, and I do, and I'm shameless about it. I think it's one of the best things a wealthy person can do is to support a university,
sure,
to support young people, especially for financial aid. I mean, that's really most of the money I ask for is to support scholarships for students. The College of the Environment was something we really tried to get donors to give money to, and we were very lucky to have people support, endowed professorships for people doing environmental science. But I am very much committed to the idea that fundraising is an ability that some people, giving funds is an ability some people have, and that we give them an opportunity to have their money used really well by energetic, thoughtful faculty and students.
So, I have 3 minutes, but you've led me into another place.
Okay.
A lot of colleges and universities now have made a big deal about the environment, appropriately so. And yet, when kids graduate from colleges in an environmental science program, the places that they can go to work are really people that they might have considered while they were coming up talking about all the problems of the environment to be the enemy. What do you do about that?
Well, I think there are two things. There's the alternative energy sector, which will be growing. It's not growing as rapidly as we hope, and we hope that our president will fight harder for more support for alternative energy and clean energy generally. And the other thing that they can do is transform energy companies, which will have to change in the future to remain viable. Not because they have good consciences, not because they want to do nice things. They will have to change because that will be where money gets made and what will be a sustainable practice.
The oldest argument in the book, which is working from within.
Working from within. I think our students often feel that, oh, I can't work from within. I need to change. I have to storm the castle. But they often realize that they can effect change. And I've seen it happen. They can effect powerful change by working with people who already have power. Because if they're right, their ideas will prevail.
So when you come back the next time, Michael Roth, and I hope there will be a next time.
I hope so.
We'll talk about psychopathology in politics. We'll take a look.
We see plenty of that.
We'll take a look at the president. We'll take a look at the people who are on the other side. And I know that you're a student of politics and history and psychological thought. But is it worth our while to spend time doing that?
Why not? I think the campaign trail provides us so many interesting examples of otherwise thoughtful people acting in bizarre ways to try to cultivate support, it would certainly be enjoyable for me, and I hope for your listeners to think about why Rick Santorum wants to vomit at certain times and not other times, or what Mitt Romney wouldn't say to get votes, if there's anything he wouldn't say to get votes, or why President Obama sometimes retreats so rapidly from things we know he believes.
Well, our guest has been Dr. Michael Roth, who has served as the 16th president of Wesleyan University since 2007. His new book is Memory, Trauma, and History, Essays on Living with the Past. And again, Michael S. Roth, President Roth, we are so flattered to have had you come in and spend all this time with us.
It was my pleasure.
It's just been great.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.